everybody. Welcome to another episode of the Comic Source Podcast. I'm your host, Jace.
And I'm Rocky Comic Boom. Good to be here.
Yeah, and this is our Comic Source, Comic Boom, DC Spotlight for, I guess it would be March 30th, 2021. So all the DC books that are dropping on Tuesday, we will drop this episode on Tuesday as well. Be warned, there are spoilers. So if you haven't had a chance to check out the books, come back later and watch it on the Comic Boom YouTube channel or any podcast platform where the Comic Source is. You can take a listen. But if you've already had a chance to read the books or you just want to know what our thoughts are, we're going to go over the DC releases for this week. Before we got started, you know, Rocky and I were talking. I think it's safe to say the first couple of weeks coming out of Future State, we felt pretty good. You know, after Future State was not so great, and we thought, maybe it's not going to be so bad. And then the last couple weeks, last week and this week, you know, the quality just hasn't been there. So it's kind of, I don't know. I'm a little worried. How do you feel, Rocky?
Well, yeah, it has taken a dip. Now, having said that, I mean, the titles we're reviewing this week, frankly, I mean, they're pretty much every title we're reviewing this week, except for one, is out of continuity, really, except maybe possibly two. So it's interesting that I don't know if that's going to be a trend moving forward, but there is a large number of comic books that are, I think, consistently going to be out of continuity. Certainly this week, there's only the Flash 768 that we're reviewing, and we could maybe talk about, you know, Inferior 5, issue 5, if we're even going to do it about that. But the rest are pretty much out of continuity. Batman, Catwoman by Tom King's out of continuity. Future State, Superman, Imperius Lex is arguably out of continuity, arguably. Strange Adventures 9, you know, it's Tom King again. Other History of the DC Universe, again, kind of out of continuity, which is not a bad thing. It's just, it makes for a different week reviewing it. And so there's pros and cons to that.
Yeah, and what's interesting, right, is you hear, and DC themselves said this, well, see, that's the thing, like, when everything counts and nothing counts, or the whole Black Label thing, oh, they're out of continuity, so the creators have the freedom to tell any story they want. Usually you expect the stories to be better, and I don't know, this week they just, I didn't necessarily feel that way. So yeah, it is kind of interesting. The other big news we probably should mention, dropping on Saturday night after the virtual WonderCon. So you kind of understand why the news came out when it did, because it was after virtual WonderCon was over. But still, you wonder about dropping it late in the evening on a Saturday when a lot of people aren't paying attention. But the announcement came down that the mini event that San Diego Comic-Con, Comic-Con International, is going to put on, because there is going to be no San Diego Comic-Con this year in July, as usual. So the mini event that they had hinted at previously coming in November is actually going to be on Thanksgiving weekend, which everybody expected it to be the weekend prior to Thanksgiving, because why would you hold a show on Thanksgiving weekend? It's already the most expensive travel day of the year. This is likely, at least for, and again, this is U.S. Thanksgiving, not Canadian Thanksgiving that you know Rocky celebrates, but it's already the busiest travel weekend of the year in terms of air traffic and you know, automobile traffic. And on top of that, you may have even more people traveling this year than normal, because Thanksgiving is going to be really the first big holiday that hopefully, based on the way the vaccination numbers have gone and the way the COVID numbers have gone here in the U.S., that you think that a lot of families are going to be targeting Thanksgiving as the time when they finally get to come back together as families and see each other. So for them to do it on Thanksgiving weekend, you know, a lot of creators have already noped right out, like, nope, I'm not going to be there. And so you sort of wonder, well, is this a way for San Diego Comic-Con? Did they do it on purpose to have it on Thanksgiving weekend so that they can try out some post-pandemic procedures and sort of guarantee themselves a smaller show and not have to turn people away because, hey, there's so many people that want to go, but there's just not enough badges to go around. They want it to be smaller. Or it could be that, you know, they were just handcuffed in terms of when the San Diego Convention Center was available. You know, may have been that weekend may have been available.
Well, and that's November then. So instead of July, it's in November, right?
It's in November, right? Yeah. So it's going to be, I mean, they already said they knew when they canceled the show in July, we already knew it was going to, San Diego Comic-Con this year was not going to be anything like it normally was. It was going to be a much smaller show, only 3 days as opposed to the 5 that it usually is. And we already knew it was going to be smaller. You're not going to see many Hollywood studios or whatnot. It may, that San Diego Comic-Con convention center may have only been available that weekend. So it's going to be interesting to see how it all plays out. I was kind of thinking, yeah, it's not that far. It's a 5-hour drive for me. Sure, I'll go. But, you know, now I'm thinking, do I really want to fight the trap? I mean, it's a lot of traffic, a lot of automobile traffic. Planes are crowded. Hotels already sold out that weekend. Just for people traveling for Thanksgiving, you know, so it's going to be interesting to see how it plays out. We'll have to wait and see as it gets closer. I mean, I want to get back to normal and get back to conventions as much as everybody else, but it may just not make sense to have it go down. But anyway, we'll keep talking about it throughout the year. I'm sure there's going to be a lot more, you know, news coming out, and it may just be a situation where once the guest list comes out and there's nobody there, then what's the point of going, you know? It may be a more comic centric show. But San Diego's not really a show where you go shopping because the vendor spaces are so expensive. The books are expensive. So I, you know, like I said, we'll wait and see. I'm sure we'll be talking about it a lot more as it gets closer. So anyway, let's go ahead and kick it off with the first book we're going to talk about. Rocky mentioned us having only one book that's sort of in the main DC continuity, and that's Flash number 768. New writer on the Flash, who's coming in to take over the writing duties. It's Jeremy Adams. We have Brandon Peterson, Marco Santucci, David LaFuente listed as artists. Mike Atea, Arif Prianto, Luis Guerrero on colors, with Steve Wands on letters. So for all, having as many artists as we have, I didn't feel the artwork was too disparate. I felt like it, you know, all these artists managed to make their styles gel together. And then the color, you know, you must have had each color artist working with each, you know, particular artist. That must have been paired up that way. But anyway, what did you think of this this book, Rocky? What were your thoughts?
Well, one thing about The Flash is at least we're dealing with Wally West. And, you know, writer Jeremy Adams is, you know, he dived right in. I thought it was very curious. I like that it's focusing on Wally West. We're focusing on the Speed Force, and we're actually, Jeremy Adams is dealing head on with the fallout of not only the death metal, but the fallout from the continuing fallout of Heroes in Crisis. Wally West has decided that he wants to give up being the Flash. And story-wise, I think it's very interesting. I find it very odd that he would make that choice, but, you know, people might disagree with me on that. It's interesting because Wally West finally ends up with Linda and the twins. He's finally got his kids back at the end of Flash Forward. He got Linda. He got the kids back at the end of Death Metal. Of course, at the end of Death Metal, the Omniverse was essentially recreated. But unfortunately, apparently one of the things that was not undone was Heroes in Crisis. So characters like Green Arrow still very much resent Wally West and clearly blame him for the death of Roy Harper, who, while I guess we know is actually still alive, but I don't think the heroes of the DC universe quite are aware of that yet. But in the meantime, Wally West wants to give up being the Flash because he just, as long as he's got speed, he's always going to be forced to use it. But one thing that's completely unexplained here is he's got two kids that have a connection to the Speed Force. So Wally West asking Barry Allen to disconnect him, to help him become disconnected from the Speed Force, seems incredibly, well, foolish almost. And dare I say, irresponsible as a parent? Like, you got two kids that are going to have super speed. They're not losing their connection to the Speed Force. If you're so concerned about your connection to the Speed Force and you're such a great father, why aren't you disconnecting your children from the Speed Force? It just seems rather, it just seemed almost like a forced way to create a plot to me. But I can understand, on the one hand, Wally West just wants to disconnect himself from the speed. He wants to just focus on Linda and the kids, and the fact that his kids will continue to have super speed powers. I guess he thinks he can teach them and raise them right, despite having no connection to the Speed Force himself.
Do they have a connection currently, though? Because I don't remember them having powers in Flash Forward. Well, I know they have had them in the past.
Well, I don't know. Is that it? I guess don't they? Or is that, or is that, are those as future kids in the 31st century or descendants or whatever? I thought they did, but.
Well, in the past, obviously they did. And they manifested when they were a little older than they are, at least older than the age they were in Flash Forward.
Okay. So well, maybe I stand to be corrected.
Maybe they don't have it yet. I mean, I don't think it's been established, but your point still stands. Even if they don't have a connection to the Speed Force yet, the lineage is there for them to have a connection to the Speed Force at some point.
Yeah.
And you would think Wally would, want a connection himself.
Well, but you make a good point. And you could be 100% right. Maybe I'm wrong and I'm just sort of confused coming out of the Omniverse, coming out of Death Metal. Maybe these kids don't have a connection to the Speed Force, but Wally West clearly does. He's sort of like the chosen one, of the Speed Force. And I'll give Jeremy Adams a compliment in terms of something is wrong with the Speed Force. And because the irony of this story, which I thought was kind of nice, interesting, was Barry, in helping Wally disconnect from the Speed Force, ends up disconnecting all the speedsters from the Speed Force except for Wally, who is apparently the Speed Force is trying to heal itself. And it's, they get help from Mr. Terrific, and they get some guidance from even President Superman. They just reference President Superman of the Justice League Incarnate. And so there's some nice references to other heroes. And I really like the job that Jeremy Adams did and sort of in incorporating all this stuff and all the questions that I'm asking. It might sound that I'm a little bit frustrated, but the truth is that I'm on board. I'm interested to see where this is going. I love seeing Linda again. I would have liked to have seen the kids in this issue. I would like to know if they are connected to the Speed Force or aren't they. I don't want them to be aged up like they did with John Kent. I'd like to see them stay younger for a while and have Wally, even if he remains the Flash, to still have some time with his kids and at least maybe get those father child and those parenting of young superhero stories that were deprived of in the mainstream DC universe between Superman and John Kent. And the art here, there's more than one artist. There's three different artists, three different colorists, but strangely enough, I felt it all connected. I like the art. It mind you, I don't know if you'll like the art, because it was very similar to the art in the Future State Flash, but I seem to recall I like the art a little bit more than you did during Flash Future State. But Brandon Peterson, I really like I really like his art, that the pages that he drew, and I thought all the artists were somewhat similar. And I'm really curious as to where this is going. If we're going to get new rules for the Speed Force, I like that. I always thought Joshua Williamson did a terrible job in confusing things and creating new forces and mixing up all the rules. And now with the Speed Force trying to heal itself, I hope we streamline some rules for the Speed Force as opposed to adding more nuance and adding more complications to it. I guess mileage will vary on that. What do you think?
Yeah. I mean, I think the whole concept of hyper time is sort of what this Omniverse is. When you want everything to count, that's hyper time that Mark Waid created, where you shift things around, you have your cake and you eat it too. Sort of what the Omniverse is. As far as the story goes, it is a little strange for Wally. Like, I understand his motivations in terms of the story, but editorially it's a little wonky, right? We just saw at the end of Infinite Frontier Zero with Barry saying, "Hey, I'm going to go be a part of what's it called, Justice." Incarnate or whatever it is.
Yeah, Justice League Incarnate. Yeah,
yeah. And you're going to be you are the Flash now for Justice League. And then here we go with the first, and you and I both were confused on which Flash it was in Brian Michael Bendis's. He was wearing a lab coat like Barry, but he had orange hair like Wally. So who knows? But here we have, Barry, actually you can't go be part of Justice League Incarnate because Wally's decided he's going to give up, the power, the speed. And so again, it makes sense from a storytelling standpoint why he just got Linda and the kids back, like you intimated, Rocky, and he wants to spend time with them and he wants to remove the danger of that. And once having lost it, now having it back, he's gonna hold on you know, maybe tighter than ever. So that all makes sense. But editorially, it's like, wait, you just told us one thing and now we're flipping around. And, you know, we both know that at the end of the day, Wally's not going to lose his powers and he's going to be the Flash going forward. This is just a way to, like you said, generate a story, generate some drama. And so, you know, whatever. But I just didn't feel that it was, I mean, it's a cool idea, and him getting trapped in the Speed Force and going back to the Jurassic period. And, you know, he's in a caveman who has, you know, Speed Force powers. And it was kind of fun. I almost wish he'd stayed in that period a little longer. Instead of the end of the issue, he jumps again with another kind of Speed Force explosion. And now he's in Bart Allen's body in the future, which again is kind of fun and cool. Yeah. But I don't know. It just didn't hook me. And I also find it kind of strange. Like, so why is Jeremy Adams writing this? Not that I felt that he didn't do an okay job, but in Future State, he wrote the Black Adam story that we really enjoyed, which was mm-hmm. sort of a Justice League story. And then he wrote the Black Racer story in the Superman Worlds of War. And Brandon Vietti wrote the Flash stuff. Not that we particularly like the Flash story. So I don't know. It's just weird. Like most of the other books, you know, whoever wrote the Future State, like Future State Suicide Squad, for example, Robbie Thompson wrote, and Robbie Thompson's writing Suicide Squad. So it's just kind of strange. This has just felt meh to me. It's an average book. As far as the art goes, there's nothing I can point out and go, oh, this is terrible. There is one thing about Brandon Peterson's art that always bugs me. And he does kind of the first part of the book. He always outlines his characters, like the figures, with some sort of color. And it's just off-putting to me that everybody's outlined in a color. Like, why are you doing that, Brandon? Like, just like it's so strange. Like, if you look at that page with Barry standing there going, "What do you mean you quit, Wally?" And you can see, you know, Batman, Superman, Green Arrow, what's her name, Naomi, and they all have an outline around them of a different color, and it pulls me out of the story because of the way the art looks. And I just don't know why he does that. But overall, I mean, the art's fine. These are all quality artists, and, you know, the storytelling, the transitions, the color work is done really well. For me, the book is the most fun when they're in while he's in the Jurassic period.
There was one line in there where I thought was pretty good that encapsulates the issue, where Wally says that he spends so much time running toward danger that maybe running toward danger is running away from a life that matters. And I thought that I actually chuckled, because I actually think that's something that Barry Allen should take to heart, because I've always considered that Barry Allen doesn't have much of a life himself, because he's constantly running toward danger, and he's Barry Allen, especially under Williamson, had basically such a terrible life. And at least kudos to Wally West for at least entertaining the possibility of happiness without being the Flash. So again, overall, I think this is pretty good. I mean, Jeremy Adams, this is a very hard character to write right now. There's a lot of people pissed off at the Flash in general, whether it's Barry Allen or Wally West. And it's really hard to please us, Flash fans, whether we're Barry Allen or Wally West. And all in all, I thought this was a decent start moving forward. And it's, but you know, we'll have to see where it goes.
Yeah. I just wonder about the pacing, like I said, because the most fun part of the issue was when he was with the hanging around with the dinosaurs. But I mean, I felt like that could have been a whole issue, but it, you know, he already jumped. And like, I would have liked to explore, like, wait, so there was a caveman that had a connection to the Speed Force. There was a caveman Flash. That's basically what you're telling me. I want to know more about that. That sounds interesting. That sounds fun. But we didn't get much. He already jumped. And obviously it wasn't really the caveman Flash, because Wally was, you know, had sort of displaced his personality or his consciousness. So I guess we'll see. I mean, I'm in for another issue. I'll give Jeremy Adams another one. It wasn't terrible, but it just felt like it was kind of average. And I would say the art is a little above average. I think the color work by the three color artists on it was even better than the actual line work. I think that's the best part of the art. Beautiful colors throughout this book. So all right, up next we have Batman, Catwoman. As Rocky mentioned, this is another out of continuity, sort of, maybe it could be pulled back into continuity. Basically, Tom King finishing off his Batman Catwoman story that he started telling in the pages of Batman and hoped to have, you know, 100-issue run, and it didn't end up working out. And now, you know, all of this that's being told in this story is far removed from the current continuity of Batman. So Tom King writer, Clay Mann handles the art, Tameyu More on colors, and Clayton Cowell on letters. We haven't talked about any Batman Catwoman. So maybe before we dive into the issue itself, Rocky, how have you felt about this series overall? Have you been reading it?
I have been reading it, and I actually thought I was looking forward to it, because all of the faults that Tom King's Batman had that ultimately led to him getting fired, quite frankly, off Batman, is the fact that he could never answer the one question that DC kept asking him, because they wanted to know where the story was going 6 issues hence, because they needed a plan, and he never really had a plan. And his Batman run was cut short to 85 issues. It was originally going to be over 100 issues. It was cut short to 85. And there was a reason for that. And his Batman storyline ended very abruptly. It was riddled with plot holes with the whole Flashpoint Batman storyline and yada, yada, yada. Having said all that, I believe, and I'm not the only one who will say this, that the Tom King's favorite character is Catwoman. Throughout Tom King's Batman run, Catwoman was always elevated to higher status. She took out all the Flashes, Catwoman by herself. She took out Talia al Ghul by herself. She defeated the Joker. She was the only one. She was sort of like almost like the hero of the War of Jokes and Riddles. She was in many ways, Catwoman was elevated by Tom King. And of course there was the Batman Catwoman romance. It was the failed wedding. This Batman Catwoman storyline that he was talking, this 12 issues, in many ways, it's like, okay, so what was he going to do with the Batman Catwoman romance? And very clearly, I got to tell you, these first 4 issues, this is him incorporating. It's like Tom King likes incorporating other books. He likes incorporating books of literature and incorporating even movie concepts in his stories. And here he clearly watched the Batman animated show with the Phantasm there, A Mask of the Phantasm. And the Phantasm, this Andrea, I forget her last name. She's the Phantasm. She was killed in Mask of the Phantasm, but she shows up here, and This is really the story that continues, and it has to be out of continuity. It has to be. It just has to be, because it goes back and forth between the present and the future. And the present deals with, or let me jump to the future. The future deals with, well, Batman, he technically dies in Batman Annual 2. Tom King had Batman die of, I guess, Alzheimer's or whatever it was. And in the future, the first issue starts off with Selina essentially purportedly killing the Joker for revenge for what he did to Andrea's child, which is the Phantasm's child. And then it flashes back trying to tell the story as to what exactly happened. And then meanwhile, we get Batman and Bruce and Selina's kid, the future Batman, Helena, as the future Batman, ultimately doing an investigation, trying to find out her mother's secrets, her mother, Selina Kyle's secrets, and her father's secrets, because apparently there's a lot about them she doesn't know. And she thinks that her mother, Selina, has a past relationship with the Joker that she wants to know more about. And so Tom King is weaving sort of a mystery here and a tale that it's frustrating. He's engaging in the same narrative practices he did in his Batman run, where he would introduce a concept, but then he wouldn't go back to it. But you think he must, because it's kind of an interesting plot point, but then he'd ignore it. And so there's some really interesting moments here in these first 4 issues. And in this moment, in this issue in particular, there's some really interesting questions being raised. Why does Selina really hates the Joker? We know at some point in the future, Selina kills the Joker. What are some of the secrets that she has regarding the Phantasm? And there's even a scene here where Catwoman has her cat actually attack and kills the Penguin. That actually traumatized me, because I love penguins. I hate cats. How can you draw a scene with a cat attacking a penguin? But it shows Selena, her daughter Helena's going around asking all of Batman's former rogues gallery, you know, tell us about the relationship between Catwoman and Joker. And it's like, what? Like, really? Like, where's that coming from? Like, not a sexual relationship, but just they had some connection and it's really, really odd. And then it flashes forward to the present and it has Batman confronting Catwoman and they're going to a gala and there's going to be, and Selena confesses to him that the Joker's planted a bomb under an ice rink and that really upsets him. And so they're not communicating well. And let me just say this. Normally when in a comic book, and you and I know this from all the, you know, we've read enough comic books to know, and a lot of people listening will know that you can tell the difference between a present and a past because the art will usually give away, will help the reader understand that one scene is in the past and one scene is in the present. There's none of that here. There's literally transitions from scene to scene on various pages where we're jumping back and forth through three different periods of time, the past, the present, and the future, and you don't know it. There's no indication. There's no change in the coloring. There's no change in the shading. There's no change in the artistic style. It's very, very frustrating for me. And I'm not sure if that's intentional on the part of Tom King telling Clay Mann to do it that way, or if it's just Clay Mann isn't, he's a good artist, but maybe he's just not up to speed. But the colorist, Tom Amore, again, at decent enough job, but I think that there's a good story here. But you know what? I said the same damn thing when I was reviewing Tom King at times, waiting for a big payoff that never came. And there's a lot of interesting plot points here, but I don't know if I have the confidence to think that they're going to be resolved at some point. And in the meantime, I remain confused, like so many of us remain confused on his Batman run. And we never got those plot lines resolved because Tom King never, in fact, knew what he was doing. And I fear that by the time we get to this end of this series, that none of this is going to come together. But I hope that I'm wrong.
Yeah, I sort of disagree with you on his Batman run. He did get fired. Like, there's no beating around the bush. The sales weren't there. There was controversy, you know, from the start. I won't lay all the blame at Tom's feet because, you know, obviously with, you know, the Button storyline and how that should have tied in with DC Rebirth and Doomsday Clock. And then, you know, Doomsday Clock goes from being a 1 year, 12 issue to a 2 year bi-monthly and editorial doesn't know what they're doing. And then, we're going to do 5G and then we're not going to do 5G and all that kind of stuff. And yeah, I mean, he was kind of the timeline, the way it went slow and got stretched out. I don't think it was 100% his fault. Could he have done a better job? 100%. He could have done a better job. But that's the thing. This is the way Tom King works. This is the way his brain works. And if he gets pulled off of something early, then yeah, you end up with a bunch of things unresolved, you know, and he 100% had confidence because he was told by Dan Didio that he was going to get his 100 issues. So I do sort of disagree that he didn't know what he was doing. I think he did, but he had to change things at times and it did make things more confusing. And then he never got to finish. So this is, you know, as you said, where he gets to finish. But again, to your point with these three different timelines, it does get confusing. And I would say it's the same sort of thing that that I have problems with Strange Adventures. And it's less so because it's a less important character and there's not as much going on. And you know, it works with Mr. Miracle because, again, you're telling a smaller story. Here we're telling a really big story where he's trying to tie up all those things. And the most important thing to him in Batman's life is that relationship that he has with Catwoman. And so, yeah, I was really excited for the story, but I thought the first issue was pretty good. I remember reading the second issue and just being like, what? I was lost the whole time. I read it twice and it didn't really improve. And then issue three, I felt like I had a pretty good handle on. This one is okay. But when I read that second issue the second time, and I still felt confused, what I sort of realized and have sort of resigned myself to is that until I have all 12 issues of Batman Catwoman and I can read them all together in one sitting and get the whole story, it's just going to be confusing. Because like you said, there's no difference in coloring. They're not choosing to give us, you know how back in the day, you know, you and I are old enough to remember this. Whenever it was a flashback in a comic, they would do rounded corners on the panels. You remember that? And you always knew it was a flashback. The rounded corners. Well, you know, a lot of times now they're not even panel breaks on the page, but you can do a sepia tone, or you can do something. You can make the word balloons a different color. You can do something to help show. And we, like you said, Rocky, we don't get any of that here. So it ends up reading like you got to put a lot of effort into this.
You do. Yeah.
And honestly, I'm of the opinion at this point, because I'm not a big fan of the Batman Catwoman relationship. I am a fan of Tom and his work. And I love Clay Mann. I think his art is spectacular. But I'm not at the point where I feel like putting that much effort into this book. I'm going to buy all the issues and I'm going to read them as they come out. And so then when I have them all in front of me and I can read it all together in one sitting, now I've read them all twice, maybe some of them three times, and I feel like I'm going to get a pretty good story. But I'm not willing to put in the time, and maybe some people are, maybe they're big fans of Batman. Maybe they love the Batman Catwoman dynamic. Maybe they're big fans of Mask of the Phantasm and they want to put it in there. But I don't know, man, I feel kind of like the shine of it, the excitement of it, it's worn off at this point. You know, it took so long for this to come out after Tom's run was over. And I know it's because Clay Mann's art is so detailed and he's on the slower side, and I get that, but they lost any momentum they had from King's Batman run shifting into this. Hey, Batman run is over with 85. Now you can go jump on Batman Catwoman and continue the story. So they lost the momentum. I don't hear many people talking about this book. I don't know what it's doing sales wise. I haven't bothered to look, but yeah, it just feels like another one of those kind of meh. And maybe when it's all said and done and it's collected all together, it'll work. I hope it will, because like you said, there are some cool concepts here with Helena as the new, you know, Batwoman and her cool looking costume. And the fact that Selina went out and killed the Joker when he's an old man. There are cool concepts here. And even the friction we see between Bruce and Selina, well, actually I should say between Batman and Catwoman here, where they're supposed to be in love. They're supposed to be working together. And they're basically cussing each other out on rooftops because they're pissed off at each other. and so there are interesting things here, but is it enough to wade through the shifting timelines where things aren't clear? For me, no. I'm just going to read them and understand it as best I can and get through it. And then when it's all said and done, I'll read it again together. And hopefully, like you said, it'll make sense and it'll all be tied up and it'll feel like a good story. Really the most disappointing thing for me, because I thought this was a fine issue, you know, certainly bet. I mean, for me, issue two is the low point where I just felt lost the whole time. This one had a good narrative and we're moving forward with the story. And, you know, technically I thought everything was fine. The interior art was fine. The pacing, the dialogue, everything worked great. The only thing technically that I didn't like about the issue, we got three different covers. There's one by Clay Mann. There's a second by Jim Lee. And there's a third. Who did the third one? The third one's by Travis Charest, another superstar artist. So you got Jim Lee, superstar, Travis Charest, superstar, Clay Mann, superstar. Like, all of these guys are great, great artists. I think every one of these covers sucks. Like they're just bad. Like the Clay Mann cover feels really unpolished, not finished at all. Travis Charest cover kind of the same. And the Jim Lee one looks really muddy with this future Batwoman we get of Helena Wayne. So when I went through to do my order, when I ordered this book, I was like, man, which cover do I want? It's like choosing between which one sucks the least, basically. So that's the biggest problem I had with the issue, you know, in this particular issue. The problems I have with the story are kind of emblematic of the series overall. And I just wonder if Tom King wouldn't be better suited to just, write these things. When you're writing these stories like Mr. Miracle or Strange Adventures or Batman Catwoman, can we just wait till they're all written and done completely and DC can just release it as like a nice hardcover and you get the whole story at once? I think his work reads better that way.
Yeah, it's really weird because I gave what I thought was somewhat of a glowing review of his Rorschach. I've really enjoyed his Rorschach.
Yeah, his Rorschach's
that story is really coming together well in Rorschach. And yet for some reason, I just find myself Rorschach. I can read and I'm really intrigued by it. And I'm excited for it. And I'm looking forward to the next issue. But is Batman Catwoman, I'm confused, but not in a good way. I'm frustrated. I'm frustrated with the art's great, but I'm frustrated with the transitions in the art and the way it was put together. I think that creatively, I don't think it's in sync very well. It's just something's not flowing for me. And I mean, I hope, as you say, it'll come together, you know, when it's all one cohesive story, but I don't know, man. I don't know.
Yeah, you very well might be right. It might not come together, and that's the danger. And that's why I wouldn't recommend anybody actually pick this up, because I can't in good conscience say it is going to come together. So, you know, your mileage may vary. But I will say one thing about his Rorschach, because we're both really, really enjoying that. That is a smaller story in scale and scope. It does feel a little more intimate. So that might be where it works a little better, you know, as a serial, you know, with one chapter each month, as opposed to this one. This is a big story spanning three different timelines. And again, I go back to the fact that it's not delineated well enough for us to understand what the hell's going on and which timeline we're in. That's the biggest problem with this book in my mind. So, all right, well, let's move on to the next book. It's The Other History of the DC Universe, number 3, written by John Ridley. We have art by Giuseppe Camincoli with finishes by Andrea Cucci. Colors are by Jose Villarubia and letters are by Steve Wands. And this is another one, you know, sort of out of the main continuity, although it references some of the, you know, most important events in these characters' lives. And it also references events that happen in our world and in real life in terms of a lot of civil rights or different events that have happened that sort of affect that. But we haven't had a chance to talk about it on the spotlight. So is this a series you've been reading and enjoying, Rocky?
It is. And this third issue focuses on Kitana of the Outsiders. And I got to tell you, man, I love this. And, you know, on the very first page, it tells you that it deals with the timeline. This is book 3 and it's between 1983 and 1996, which is quite frankly, I started collecting comics in 1976 and the 83 to 96 was kind of my golden, still probably just I'm entering the silver age of my own comic collecting life. And man, I read all the Batman, read all the Outsiders. I was right into Kitana. This was right up my alley, this issue. And I had no idea. Honestly, Kitana was never my favorite member of the Outsiders. I was sort of Black Lightning and Geo-Force I thought was cool, but Kitana is my new favorite member. This, I felt like I was reliving my teenage comic collecting life. This was a great summary of the DC universe, but from a Batman and the Outsiders perspective. You're getting a miniature history of the DC universe, and the brilliance of this and the brilliance of what John Ridley has done here is that, and I'm going to get on a soapbox here in a minute too, whether you like it or not. I love the fact that he incorporates a little bit of common sense that, of course, you know, she's Japanese, and there was racism, there was bigotry, there was a consequence to being Japanese at the time, and you're a superhero and you got to address that. And she's got an extraordinary past to begin with, losing her children in a grievously violent manner, losing her husband, being her husband decapitated by her enemy, and becoming an assassin, trying to find meaning in her life, and then ultimately coming to America and then dealing with the you could call it systemic racism against the Japanese. And this isn't forced on you in any way, shape, or form. Anybody who thinks that this is forced on them, quite frankly, I'll just say it right now, I think is you know, hallucinating and making crap up that just isn't there. This is really great storytelling. You get the references used, the to the various times in American history where there was racism against the Japanese. This isn't forced on you. This is just the backdrop of showing to help build this character so you get to know her more. The most significant parts of this narrative is you get to know Katana herself. You get to know her connection to her kids and to herself and her journey and her failures and her successes and how she was always the best at what she did. And then her confrontation with Shiva and her dying and almost embracing her death, but then not dying and coming back and relearning those same lessons, but always in the context of the outsiders and coming back. And I love the fact how she disagreed about the name of the Outsiders. She talked about how she didn't like the name Batman and the Outsiders because the Outsiders almost gave the connotation that, you know, she's an immigrant and there's a black man on it and she's, you know, and she's Japanese. And then they got a genetic freak with Metamorpho, and calling them the Outsiders, she almost kind of resented it. And you could understand why. And because this is the stuff that we never got spelled out in the comic books, because we got more of the Vanilla Sky version in the comic books. And this is more of a character building. This is the raw story of a character that is a brutal character that's went through hell and had to explore trying to find her own motherhood again, her own maternity, essentially by being a surrogate mother, a de facto mother to Halo, and then losing her and how that relationship went awry. This is just fantastic. And I love the fact that I like that this was a quasi comic. It's pictures, but I like the substance. I liked reading this. I sat back and I enjoyed reading this. And if, you know, it's not all pictures, I love getting into the words, and I love the richness of it, and I love the exposition. That's John really shows his strength as a I guess his background as a screenwriter here, I think, is really coming into play, because I'm going to stop talking now, man. But I just really enjoyed this.
Yeah, I mean, and we talked about this on our Best of 2020 show, how great the other history of the DC Universe has been. I will say this is, it's not my favorite issue of the series so far. That's still reserved for me for the first one that focused on Black Lightning, because it was so powerful. And that might just have to do with the fact that, you know, Black Lightning as an African-American man and the struggles, and it's been so much more, you know, kind of documented, and it's so much more sort of the struggle between race, you know, with the slaves and whatnot in this country, it's so much more ingrained in our history and civil rights. And so that was very powerful. That's not to say that we haven't had a lot of racism against Asians, which John really explores in this. And I think that's just as important to explore. And certainly it's very appropriate, and it's very, you know, right now with the COVID virus and people blaming, people of Asian descent who have absolutely nothing to do with it. They're here for three or four generations. They've been Americans, and they're being blamed, and they're being attacked randomly in the streets. So this is a very relevant and sort of timely story for this to come out. And it's so interesting how in comics, how sometimes these sort of things happen. Certainly DC and John really didn't plan for this to come out right now when there's been all this violence against Asians. But it's a good reminder that, you know, this isn't the first time. And John really references an event that happened back in the early to mid 80s, a man who he was out at his bachelor party, and he got beaten to death with a baseball bat by a man and his stepson who had been laid off from his job in the automotive industry, because this man was Chinese. He wasn't even Japanese. But the Japanese, that was the time when smaller cars were taken over because of the energy crisis and whatnot. And so the American automotive industry was going through a lot of layoffs and going through a lot of tough times. And they attacked this Asian man because they assumed he was Japanese when he wasn't. He was, first of all, he was like third generation Chinese American, wasn't even Japanese. And they attacked and they killed him, and there was basically no consequences for them. They never spent a day in jail. They had like a $3,000 fine. It was just ridiculous. And I had never heard of this. This was kind of, you know, before my time. And the man who died, his name was Vincent Chin. But that's the power of this sort of storytelling that Ridley's doing, that I stopped while I was reading this. And I went and I investigated because I wanted to know the story of Vincent Chin. And it's important. It's important for these type of stories to be told. It's wonderful that John Ridley is bringing real life events, because it educates us and it informs us and it reminds us that, hey, we need to learn from our history. We need to learn from the events of the past where hate and bigotry have caused people's lives to be changed irrevocably. And that's been the power of this other history of the DC universe, you know, and it's right there in the title. This is the other history. It's not the history that you know with Batman and Superman and Flash and Green Lantern and Wonder Woman, these Caucasian heroes who, you know, sort of live life on easy mode. Let's take a look at the DC universe in terms of the other marginalized, the people that aren't at the center of it. And to your point, Rocky, about Katana, I read Batman and the Outsiders back in the 80s too. I wasn't a big Katana fan at that time. She's the way she was written back then was a little stereotypical. She just felt like, you could think of Black Lightning as angry black man, Katana was, you know, angry older Asian woman, you know, just that's how she came across to me. And I never was that invested. And it wasn't until the new 52 with her new design by Richard Friend, where she looked much younger, that I started getting interested in her. And I read her solo series and really liked it. And so I was looking forward to this, because what Ridley does is he sort of, because that felt like a totally different Katana, right? When the new 52 happened and she was in the Birds of Prey for a while and whatnot. Ridley does a good job right at the end of this issue of sort of bringing those sort of disparate different versions of Katana together. And we get much more of an insight into who she is and the fact that she did have feelings and she did have emotions. And she even addresses it, Katana, as she's relaying the story to us about how, after losing her husband and losing her family, how she purposefully didn't feel anything. You know, she suppressed her emotions. And that's the way that she always came across in those classic Mike W. Barr issues, of her not really having emotions or feelings. And you never really understood it. It was never really explained. And Ridley here, he's going back. He's read all those books and he's giving us an in-continuity, an in-story reason, and a good one that makes total sense for why Katana was the way she was. And it's a great evolution of the character throughout this history we get of her, in addition to all the other things that he's exploring about race and how even people that have been in this country for a long time. He goes over the Japanese internment, which is obviously a kind of a stain on American history, because again, you had these Asian families who had been here for generations that were just rounded up with no due process, with no evidence, and just imprisoned. And so he does a great job, and he has throughout the series, of incorporating real world events and giving us those events in the context of the DC universe with these sort of superhero stories. So yeah, I mean, we may have had some issues with Ridley when he was doing the more traditional type comic work in the Future State Batman title. Here it's more of a prose work along with some great artwork. And yeah, I mean, I love this. This works really, really well. And it's why I was excited to have him do Batman, just based on the quality of this work. But obviously he's more comfortable working in this sort of prose type format than he is in working in traditional comic book form. And like Rocky said, that's probably due to his screenwriting background. So I think he'll get it. He's a smart guy and he clearly is talented. So I think that, you know, eventually he'll get there with the regular sort of traditional comic book structure. But if you're not reading the other history of the DC universe, we talked about it during the Best of 2020 show. We recommended you read it. This is just another example. I mean, it is so spectacular. The artwork is great. Both of the covers on this book are awesome. And I can't recommend it highly enough. Far and away, my favorite DC book of the week. It's not even close.
Yeah, I like the different versions. And there's one beautiful page where it almost looks like the Japanese flag with the different versions of Katana on the different displays are following. And in the middle of the circle is the final image of Katana, which is her modern day almost Suicide Squad version. I just really like that. We got you, if you're a Katana fan, and even if you're not, you're going to really grow to love this, this version of the character. And you're going to get to know her in a way that, you're going to have a new respect for her. Cause right away, I'm actually hoping that we're going to see, Katana end up in that, League of Lazarus tournament to fighting Lady Shiva and Damien in the pages of Robin. I want to get Katana back now. Sorry, Jace.
There we go. Yeah. I was going to say, I've never been more invested in Katana than I am right now. I totally agree with everything you said. And yeah, that's a great, this is a great page. You can see it on the screen here where you can see all the different versions of her. So I'm still partial to this, like the Richard Friend original design. Cause wasn't she was Birds of Prey. She was in Justice League for a little while too, with this design, I think. So,
She's been all over the place, I think.
Yeah, they're always trying to find a spot for her. So, all right, up next, we have a book that I haven't read any of the issues. I think Rocky had said when we were talking about this, he may be the only one who's buying it. I haven't heard anybody talking about this book. but, hey, there are fans of Inferior Five out there. When you look at the name, I mean, it's Keith Giffen on plot and pencils, and Jeff Lemire on plot and script. I mean, those are two incredibly talented creators. Michelle Dalecki's handling the inks, Hi-Fi on colors, and Rob Lee on letters. So let her rip, Rocky. What's going on in Inferior Five?
Well, honestly, I thought this entire series was canceled. I think issue four came out. I actually, if you can believe this, I actually put my issues 1 through 4 in storage, I boxed them away. I assumed that this series wasn't going to end. And I was looking.
So issue 4 came out December 4th.
Wow.
the first week of December. Yeah.
Yeah. What's really interesting about Inferior 5 here is, you know, this, let me just be blunt. The backup feature is the one by Jeff Lemire. That's the Peacemaker story. He does the Peacemaker story, and it's usually only 3 or 4 pages long. So Jeff Lemire does a Peacemaker story, and it, frankly, I can't really say it's definitely not Lemire's best work at all. And Keith Giffen does the Inferior Five story, and this, it's such a crazy story. It's like, it takes place in some dystopian future on Earth where the invasion, remember there's a DC event called Invasion way back in the, I don't know if that was the late 80s, early 90s. And I remember.
Late 80s. Todd McFarlane drew the main.
Yeah. But anyway, that series introduced us to the Dominators.
Yep.
And the Dominators essentially were sort of obsessed with the metagene in the superheroes. And basically what the Inferior Five storyline is, where it's getting to, is that the Dominators, they've decided that a lot of the superheroes, the people with the metagene are dead, but their children are still alive, and they can gain more knowledge by accessing and by kidnapping and experimenting on the children of these people who possess the metagene. And a large part of the first 4 issues deal with these characters that are frankly not that particularly interesting. And the art is an acquired taste, I think, to be fair and to say the least. But here's the kicker, is that it keeps talking about an end game, about an ending battle, that because the Dominators want to invade the Earth again, but they want to create their own metahuman. They want to create their own superheroes. And they, in order to do that, they need to do more experimentations with the metahumans on Earth. And so they talk about they don't want to make the same mistake they made the first time during the first invasion, where they were handily defeated. And so they want to do it right this time. And that's where this is all going. You see on the cover to Inferior Five that there's an experiment, you know, the Dominators are experimenting on different characters. It's like I said, there's a reason why this did not heat up the sales charts. No one's talking about this. I don't even know if this still existed after the death metal. Is this future still going to happen? We got nothing, none of this in Future State. So this is a future. Is this even happening? Is this, I guess everything matters, nothing matters. you could probably very much forget about this. There's actually a page in this issue that is so funny. The kids in this issue are actually reading an issue of Invasion that doesn't actually exist. They're reading an issue of Invasion, and the entire plot point, it's like breaking the fourth wall. It's in the comic book that the kids are reading. And so it's almost a little bit of Grant Morrison-esque in there. And I don't know. It's crazy. I can't recommend that people buy this series, but you know what? There are some scenes in here that are kind of interesting, kind of maybe fun. You might get a kick out of it, but in fact, I'm going to read you an exact quote. "What's Invasion? Like some alien thing?" Yeah, it was some sort of obscure DC crossover, and for some insane reason, they just kept publishing it. That's actual dialogue from the story. For some insane reason, they kept... And that's kind of how I think all of us felt about Invasion. But in any event, it's a skip. But I gotta admit, the old DC guy in me, and I enjoyed reading it in a crazy kind of way. I could actually understand what was going on, which was kind of fairly interesting. But I think the only reason that the Peacemaker backup story is here is, talk about an afterthought. Nothing happens in the backup with the Peacemaker. Right now, I would think that they would not want... This is not really a great sign for the Peacemaker. This is a terrible Peacemaker story. Nothing literally happens here. I don't even know... I can't even explain what's happening. I don't know why DC Editorial approved this, if I'm brutally honest, other than to maybe give an old guy like me a good laugh.
Yeah, one thing about the art... it's recognizable as Keith Giffen art. I almost feel like, is Michelle Dalecki, is she afraid to mess with the art at all? You know what I mean? Cause I've seen other inkers make Giffen's art look better than Dalecki's doing. So you wonder if she's like, oh man, it's Keith Giffen. He's a legend. I'm just going to ink over the lines exactly as they are on the page. I don't want to alter anything. Yeah. Cause the art's it's a little rough. So. Anyway, moving on, we have Strange Adventures number 9. This is written by Tom King. We have art by Mitch Gerrits and Evan Doc Shaner, letters by Clayton Cowles. Another Tom King book. What do you think, Rocky?
Have you been reading this series, Jace?
So I read the first issue and then totally fell off. And then in preparation for... covering issue 9, I got caught up because I've been meaning to get caught up, and it's one of those things. I just haven't made the time to do it. I finally made the time to do it. So I literally yesterday read issues 1 through 9 all together in one sitting.
Yeah. Well, this is chapter 9. It's the title of this chapter is "The Whole World's Looking." And essentially the whole world is looking, and they're looking to Adam Strange because Adam Strange really is a man of two worlds. He's got a beautiful wife, Alana, and he's got a daughter who was killed in the war against the Picts. And he's always straddling a life between two worlds, and he's essentially being accused of war crimes. And early on in the series, Batman asked Mr. Terrific to come on board to investigate Adam Strange to see if there was any truth to some of the allegations of war crimes against him. And because there's a lot to look into, because obviously it would be an investigation on not only two fronts, but those two fronts are two worlds, Earth and Ran. And I will say this, this is sort of middle of the road Tom King. I really like in Tom King's Rorschach, not so much as Batman Catwoman yet. This strange adventures is sort of right in the middle. But one thing that artistically works very well is the scenes on Earth, Mitch Gerrards draws those, and the scenes that have, I believe, take place more or less in the past on Ran and during the war are drawn by even Doc Shaner. And artistically, this is fantastic. And artistically, this is a much easier story to follow and to appreciate. And so even at times when I'm challenged and I'm a little bit confused as to what might be going on, I can always sort of figure it out by going back. And I like you, I've had to go back and sort of like double check and reread some issues. And this story, I think, flows well. I do like the fact that Alana and Adam Strange are struggling with the loss of their daughter. And where it's coming to a head here is Adam Strange has had to indulge in some very, very harsh and one could say, well, I mean, it's war. So you could accuse him of a war crime, but he kills a lot of picks in this issue. And he literally wipes out an entire, I guess, city of picks, and all in retaliation for what appears to be the death of his daughter. He blames Superman for not coming to his aid. He screams at Superman at one point in this issue, I begged you to come. And ultimately Superman didn't come. And I believe that was Superman doesn't want to get involved in war. And so I like the fact that it sort of challenges the idea that Superman may not choose to get involved in situations of war, but where do you draw the line? I mean, when is something a war and when isn't it? And he chose not to help Adam Strange because Superman didn't want to pick sides in what Superman saw as a civil war. Adam Strange's daughter ends up getting killed. And then Adam Strange does what he's got to do. And then the Justice League turn around and accuse him, or Batman accuses him of questionable conduct, of arguably engaging in a war crime. And then Alana at one point gives even a conference or gives a interview to a reporter, and she very much defends her husband. And this is very real world approach to looking at the heart at these actions of superheroes and how Superman and Batman and Adam Strange, they can legitimately have very different views in terms of at what point do you help each other? Why doesn't the Justice League help some worlds? How do you define a civil war? What criteria are you using? Quit being a hypocrite accusing Adam Strange of being a war criminal when you just came off death metal. This is definitely something where you'd want to read from the very beginning, from issue one. You don't want to come into this in the middle of the road. And it's probably something that if you haven't jumped on board yet to this title, that you would want to wait to the end and collect it as a trade paperback, or wait until the inevitable beautiful hardcover will come out with the beautiful art of Mitch Gerards and Evan Doc Shaner.
Yeah, I agree. There's no way you can jump on this right now with issue 9 and read forward and understand. It's not a thing. So I have mixed feelings about this. What Tom King is trying to do, along with Mitch and Doc, their goal that they set out initially when the series was announced and when Tom was giving interviews, and I talked to Tom about it, everything they're trying to do, they are succeeding. This is an exploration of truth and how the truth can change based on your perspective. And you think, well, you know, how can that be? Well, you know, with everything that's happened, and Tom lives in Washington, D.C., so certainly he's very aware of the sort of shifting truth of how things can go based on perspective. So I find that to be very interesting. Now, on the other hand, I'm sort of tired after the last 4 years of this idea of the truth yeah. being subjective. Usually you figure, you know, the truth is the truth, but that it's just not always the case and never has been. You know, clearly when worlds go to war, or, you know, two factions go to war, they strongly believe in the truth of their beliefs and the truth of their side and what they're fighting for. And you know, it's kind of the same concept of everybody's the hero of their own story, right? Well, not everybody can be on the right side. History's written by the winners, and you know, there's all these cliches we could go down the path. So that, you know, it's not exact. This isn't an uplifting story. This isn't like yay comics, but it does make you think. And the other part of it is the fact that Tom chose to tell this type of story, examining the truth with Adam Strange, is fascinating to me, because to me, Adam Strange is a very innocent Silver Age type character. You know, the stories he was in, everything was very much, you know, black and white, good guys versus bad guys. And all of a sudden, that's all being questioned. And, you know, it's up to the reader to decide, hey, was it really war crimes? There's even a question of whether or not the Picts killed Aaliyah, Adam Strange's daughter. Maybe it was Adam Strange himself, or something happened. He's hiding something. That's the kind of the what we're getting from the Mr. Terrific storyline. That he keeps, when he talks to Alana, he keeps saying, you know, you should ask your husband, because, you know, there's things that he isn't telling you. So it's very interesting, the story that is being told here, this idea of truth as a matter of perspective. And it's not the first time that I've thought about that. And in fact, there's a graphic that illustrates truth being a matter of perspective better than anything I've ever seen, and better than I can explain it myself. So I'm gonna share my screen and I'm gonna show it to you. And it's this graphic here, right? This looks like a square, and that is true, that this is the truth, and it fits through that square. But if you're looking at it from this other perspective, oh, look, it's actually a circle, and it fits through here in this circle. And a lot of times, that is the truth, right? It all depends on your perspective. If you're looking at this shape through here, it looks like a square. If you're looking at it through here, it looks like a circle. Both can actually be true. And I think that is the best way to kind of describe what Tom King and Mitch Gerads and Doc Shane are trying to do here. Because Rocky himself, he said it, right? It's like Adam Strange is a man of two worlds, and he's trying to protect what he loves on Ran. And all of a sudden, from the perspective of Earth, oh, what you've done is terrible. And you know, when he gassed all the people in this issue and he killed a bunch of Picts in the city, he's just trying to save his way of life. The one thing I wonder about is we did see a scene earlier in the series where Alana and Adam Strange kind of met with the Picts, and they agreed to sort of the conventional rules of warfare. Oh, we agree to what Oa says. And you wonder if gas or chemical weapons were outlawed. And so that's the way they're kind of breaking things, where they're not going along with what they are supposed to be doing. But, you know, war is hell. And when you're trying to defend yourself, you're fighting for your life, man, you do whatever you have to do. Forget about any rules. You do whatever you have to do to survive and keep your family safe. If my family was threatened, I wouldn't care about any rules. I would just do whatever I had to keep them safe. And so you're right, Rocky. It's powerful stuff here in this issue, where that scene where he's yelling at Superman, I begged you to come and help. I begged you, you know, and you turned your back. You're just a day, a few hours of Superman's help could have prevented how many deaths? You know, and now the justice is going to turn around and judge me for doing what I had to do to keep my family safe. So, like I said, it's not an uplifting story. It is an interesting story. And it's another one of those where, just like Batman, Catwoman, it's going to be hard to judge until it's completely finished. But the artwork, like you said, Rocky, is spectacular. There's particularly my favorite scene in this issue is Adam Strange when he's kind of undercover and he goes into the Pick City, and he's kind of looking back over his shoulder. It's just an incredible scene by Doc Shaner. I mean, just look at that. It's gorgeous. It's beautiful.
It is. It's really good.
Yeah. He's on his clandestine mission. So yeah, this is a very interesting series. It's one that will definitely make you think, but yeah, you can't jump on now if you haven't been reading all along. Because it's definitely a story that builds as it goes. So, all right, on to the last book we're going to talk about. It's actually a Future State book. There was one Future State series that had three issues that carried over into March. And it's Superman versus Imperius Lex. And let me find the credits here. It's written by Mark Russell. We have art by Stephen Pugh, colors by Romulo Fajardo Jr., and letters by Carlos M. Mangual. So what were your thoughts? Final Future State book to talk about, Rocky.
Well, again, I don't mind Mark Russell. I mean, his he's got a very particular way of writing, and he always seems to speak in political satire and script in political satire, and he does it to good effect. And this is good. This was, I didn't need this third chapter. I thought it was done after two chapters. This was a part three that I didn't need, but I don't mind it. And I enjoyed it. It was sort of a nice capping off the three issue series. And again, the same sort of thing. This was, again, this involves a storyline where sometime in the future, Lex Luthor has his own planet called Lexor that has asked for membership into the United Planets. And it was forced to ask for membership into the United Planets because Lex Luthor's master plan was to build robots, these replicants that went to other worlds and pillaged other worlds. Superman stopped that. And so therefore Lexor went into recession and basically needed to join the United Planets. I'm oversimplifying it, but here we have Lex Luthor, of course, wanting to, it felt like a rehash of the previous two issues, to be honest with you. To me, the most human aspect of this storyline was Lex Luthor's robotic friend, who Lex Luthor rejects. He's got his loyal robotic little, it reminds me of Herbie from the Fantastic Four cartoon, you know, super loyal to Lex and refuses to give up on Lex. And Lex Luthor ends up betraying him and Lex Luthor's master plan, because all of Lexor needs somebody to blame because of their circumstances, because ultimately Lex Luthor is defeated was defeated last issue, and he should have been seen like a villain, but Lex Luthor gets himself involved into a PR campaign, and he figures as long as he can create a scapegoat to blame somebody else for what he did, that would be okay. And so he ends up blaming his trusty robot friend who ends up getting banished to the same moon that Superman dumped all these replicants on. And ultimately this robot, in trying to get back into Lex Luthor's good books, reactivates these replicants to try to pillage other worlds again. Chaos ensues. Ultimately they're defeated, and that's really the end of the issue. And I think the moral of the story is set on the last page, where the robot says to him, if you don't mind me saying, Lex, you ruled Lexor, a small planet, but still a world unto itself. This cell is also a world of its own, just a much smaller one. But it doesn't matter how big your world is, so long as you have a place in it. Speaking personally, I have never been happier. So there's your lesson, guys. No matter, we all have our own worlds that we live in, and they might be small, and we might not rule over countries, but we rule over our family household. So be content with what you have. That's so. It's a nice happy ending, which you can expect from most of what Mark Russell writes, along with some satire along the way.
Yeah, I agree with you. I think that was the point of having a third issue, was so Mark Russell could get to the happy ending. albeit in an ironic way. The other part of this was, you know, we did see things that were rehashed and reiterated with Lex. Oh, things are worse now because of all this inflation, because Superman, you know, created the crystals, and you know, we were going to be in the United Planets, and then we weren't going to be in the United Planets, and we found the crystals, and you thought you were going to make a fortune, and then Superman found a way to create them artificially, and now a guy takes a whole wheelbarrow full of these crystals to buy a loaf of bread. And it's just so interesting. And then when the PR people come to Lex and they're like, you know, before this, these crystals, you know, you told everybody they were going to make all this money. And now with artificial crystals, they're making less than they were before. And Lex is like, but they're making more money than they did like before money existed on this planet. Right. So it's just a matter of what you compare it to. You know, they're making more now than they did in the past. Just find the time in the past they were making less and compare it to now and tell everybody they're better off. It's all about how you spin it, right? Like Lex is the ultimate spin doctor. So there's a lot of good messages here, and Mark Russell does a great job of reiterating them. But I do feel like the reason for this existing is to give us that happy ending. The line for me that stuck out, though, is when right at the beginning when Lois and Superman are petitioning the United Planets to go help out these people, because their argument is, hey, it's not the inhabitants of the planet. It's not their fault that Lex is a scumbag, right? And we need to let them know that if they want refugee status, they can go to any other United Planet, and they will be received. And there's some argument against it. Hawkman's like, you know, these are the people that killed our survey team. They almost killed you, Superman. What makes you think they deserve mercy? And this is one of the greatest Superman lines ever written in a comic. Mark Russell gets it when it comes to Superman. Superman's response to that is, nobody deserves mercy. That's what makes it mercy. That's the point. Right. Yeah. So I thought that was very profound and a great line for Mark Russell. And ultimately, yeah, once Lois and Superman go back to the planet, the way they defeat Lex is that the inhabitants of Lexor do finally realize that Lex is not who he says he is. So that was kind of uplifting as well, that these people that have been blindly following him, believing all his lies, believing all his spin doctoring, finally wised up and realized that he's not a good guy. He's not worthy of their adulation and their worship. And they help turn the tide and they help Superman defeat Lex ultimately. And like Rocky said, was this 100% necessary? No. Did I enjoy it? Yes. I would have been happy with two issues. I even think a lot of this could have been like, you could have taken the three issues and probably edited it down to where we still could have got all the good stuff, like the mercy line and the same ending, and fit it in two issues. So kind of weird. It feels so much like an afterthought coming out, you know, almost a month after Future State was over. But I did enjoy it. I thought the art was, you know, it was solid, like we got from Steve Pugh the whole time. So it was okay. It was a nice few moments to kind of finish up the series overall. So I'd rather have Mark Russell writing Superman right now than Philip Kennedy Johnson. I'll tell you that. Just that one line, that's what makes it mercy. To me, that's better than anything that Philip Kennedy Johnson has written for Superman so far. So hopefully that'll change. But that's it. That's all the DC books for this week. It wasn't the most entertaining week. The other history of the DC universe for me stands head and shoulders above everything else. But like Rocky's point early on, a lot of this stuff is out of continuity. It's not part of the main core of the DC universe. So maybe that's why this week felt a little bit average at best. So any final words, Rocky?
I love Katana. I love Katana. Can you show me some more Katana stories? And good job, John Ridley, on the best for the week by far was the other history of the DC universe, issue 3.
Yeah, I agree 100%. So again, everybody, if you're listening to this on the Comic Source or on every platform that podcasts are found, you know, iTunes and Apple Podcasts and Google and iHeartRadio and Stitcher and all those. If you're listening to this and you're curious about being able to see the images that we share or see Rocky and my smiling face, be sure you go and check it out on YouTube, the Comic Boom YouTube channel. That's Comic Space Boom! ! Be sure you smash that subscribe button, give them a like, hit that notification bell so you know whenever he has new episodes coming out. You have anything on tap for this week, Rocky, that everybody should be aware of or ready for?
Well, I'm going to be reviewing. I'm going to be reviewing a Kickstarter comic called Soul Finder Black Tide by Douglas Ernst, and I am also going to be reviewing a couple of independent comics, which I haven't decided yet. But that, and of course, I'm going to be posting the YouTube video for this review as well.
Yeah, for me this week, I also have a Kickstarter spotlight for a book called Last Homicide, which is really, really good. We're going to have the creator on to go ahead and check that out. I also just dropped an episode last week about the Top Cow series Freeze, which is a 4-issue mini series, which has potential for so, so, so much more in the world that they've created. It's basically from one moment to the next, humanity freezes. Like all the people, they just freeze in place, but technology and everything else keeps moving. So there's car accidents and planes fall out of the sky. And, you know, what happens? There's one guy who can go around and touch people and wake them up. But everybody else is kind of frozen in place. So the moral and societal implications are huge. And unfortunately, we only got four issues. I don't think the sales were really great. So check out the episode. Go check out the hardcover. Reach out to Top Cow on social media. Tell them we want more. It's a really, really great series. So everybody do me a favor and go and give that a listen. So beyond that, we want to thank you for your support, as always, for listening or watching, whichever you prefer. And we'll talk to you next time.
You can find the Comic Source Podcast on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Play, or whichever podcasting app you prefer. Please tell all your friends about us, subscribe, and rate us. The ratings really help with our visibility and our ability to reach new listeners, especially 5-star reviews on Apple. Also, be sure to visit us at lrmonline.com to join the conversation, access the show notes, and discover all our other great pop culture content. If you want to email us, the email address is thecomicsourceblog@gmail.com, or you can follow us on Twitter, twitter.com/thecomicsource. Do a search for The Comic Source on Facebook and Instagram to follow us on those social platforms. All three spots are great places to find out when we release new episodes, as well as follow all our convention coverage. So once again, we want to thank everyone for listening, and we'll talk to you next time.